Last two times that I've spoken, we talked about the lost sheep and then the lost coin. I'll just briefly summarize here a little bit. So we're starting in about the lost sheep, and it talks about that what man among you, if he has 100 sheep and has lost one of them, doesn't leave the 99 in the open pasture and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? And when he's found it, he lays it on his shoulder, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost. And we don't have to worry about what this parable means. It has a, I forget what the word is, I should have written it down. There's a name for when a parable gives you the meaning right there. It's in one of the books that I left out in the truck. But it says right here that I tell you that the same way there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who don't need repentance. So we talked about that particular parable. We talked about some of the themes in the book of Luke, three of which are really prominent in this particular chapter, Luke 15. Luke writes about wealth. He writes about prayer a lot. He focuses on the scribes and the Pharisees and so forth. His concern, Jesus' concern for the lost, God's concern for the lost. Also a lot about the role of women, and we talked about that last time quite a bit, which I won't go through again, that Luke just has example after example after example of where, the way he writes his account of Jesus' ministry, showing how Jesus was always in touch with women and making his messages to be received by women. And that might not sound unusual today, but compared to the way it was then, that's very unusual. Nobody was thinking about whether or not the women were listening to anything back then. That's an exaggeration maybe somewhere, but in general, in the Jewish culture and the Roman culture, it wasn't that way. And Jesus was an exception to that. The lost sheep brings about this cultural thing about how shepherds were kind of looked down on, and Jesus compares the Pharisees to shepherds. So, and of course, the whole issue being that the Pharisees looked down on certain people that weren't as good as they were, weren't following the laws in a particular way. And Jesus, of course, had a ministry where he was interacting with untouchables, you know, the regular folk, the common people. And he was always being criticized for that, and that'll be part of today's message as well as we get through. But shepherds were not looked on very favorably, even though some of the heroes, many of the heroes of Israel were shepherds. But in Jesus' time, they were looked down on, and by Roman society and Jewish society both, but especially the Jewish society. And Jesus compared them all to shepherds, so it served them right, I guess. And I left this one here, I don't know why. And it says he lays it on his shoulders. We talked a little bit about the symbolism there, that in the early church, a lot of the iconography, is that how you say it? Whatever it is, the pictures that they would do, involved Jesus, not on a cross, but Jesus carrying a sheep on his shoulders. So that was something that was important in the early church. And then the parable mentions having a party of sorts, saying, "Yeah, I found the sheep," and that was showing that, you know, Jesus, God, cares about lost sheep. He cares. The people didn't always care, and some of the leaders didn't. Especially the way they looked at shepherds, that was a very negative thing. But this parable points out that Jesus actually seeks the lost. It's not so much as just if the lost come along, he'll help them out, or they have to knock on his door, but he actually seeks them out. So it's different than the way the Pharisees practice their religion and outreach. Not quite the same. All right. I need to get through here and get to the coins. I didn't realize I had so much in here. The lost coin. Talks about the woman who had 10 silver coins and lost one. I'm just reviewing this. You're probably, maybe all of you were here, maybe not. I don't know if John was here, but I'll review this just in case you weren't there. And it says that she swept the house, searched carefully until she found it. When she found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, rejoice with me, for I've found the coin which I had lost. And in the same way, again, this parable has the meaning right here with it. Uh, in In the same way, I tell you, there's joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. So we get the meaning there. And of course, this is using a woman. This is one example of what Luke does, and Jesus did it, but Luke bothered to write it down. And that Jesus makes his parables accessible to the women in society, and women were among his disciples. That was not usual, normal for a rabbi. So this is more, you know, talking about a woman's world. And there are many examples of that. What she lost was like a day's wages. So, you know, in our world today, that could amount to $100 or more. So it's not so that she lost just a coin, like if we drop a penny, we're not going to worry about it. No, this was a lot of money. So she was looking for it. We talked a little bit about the way the floors were, at least in Caesarea, that they used this basalt rocks, and there were joints between them all, where a coin could very easily fall, and it wouldn't be as shiny as that, wouldn't be as easy to find as that is. And the windows were small, and so what didn't let a whole lot of light into the room, so you had to look carefully. And so that's some of the cultural background. So she looked carefully, she found it. Lighting a lamp, why would you light a lamp in the daytime? Because the windows were small and didn't let in a lot of light. They were outside. They didn't need the windows for let light in there because they weren't going to stay in the house too much during the day. They were out doing whatever they needed to do. And of course it was work. You know, she has to look and apply some effort to find this one coin. And it again shows that Jesus cares enough that he actually puts effort into seeking out and saving the lost. And again, she has, you know, she gathers her friends and celebrates in a way finding what she had lost. All right, so here we go. And we talked, you know, some takeaways, you know, that really this is telling us the kind of attitude that God has, the kind of attitude that Jesus had in his ministry. And do we share that attitude? Do we care about the lost, or are we looking down at them in ways that Jesus continually brought out in his parables? And one of the reasons for his parable, of course, is in a sense a bit defensive, not that he had to defend himself, but he did. He was pointing out to those that would criticize him that, look, I care, and here's what I care about, and you don't. And he used these simple everyday kind of items, whether it was a coin or a sheep, to illustrate that. And, you know, that these people, you know, you care, you might care about a sheep and you might care about a coin, you don't care about real people. So he's making a point there. And we need to listen to that point because we need to care about people too. We can get all worked up about a lot of other things. But at the end of the day, as the expression is now, you know, it's all about people. It's all about people. And we listen, you know, we had these hymns today. It's so nice to have live music. Thank you, Rick. We're singing a hymn from the 14th century, it says, from the 1300s. We're singing a hymn from the 1300s with a very modern instrument here. It's kind of neat that we can do that. Anyway, we can get off on that. But Mark Graham, we sang a bunch of Mark Graham songs, and over his career, he's written songs that always are pointing to the kingdom and what people will be doing in the kingdom. And it's nice to sing those things and realize, you know, the kingdom is about people. It's not about roles. It's not about, you know, governments in a sense. I mean, it's about God's government. But what makes God's government unique is that he serves the people. And it goes the right direction. So we look forward to that. So now we come, we had the lost sheep, we had the lost coins. And the end of the chapter 15 is still, the subject is still the lost. And I have here, you know, part three, and I said the two lost sons. Well, that's not what people call it. What do people call that parable? It's the parable of the prodigal son, right? So why didn't I say the prodigal son? Well, there it is, I did. What's this? Anybody know what prodigal means? I had to look it up. I wasn't really sure. Prodigal means wasteful. Or, you know, extravagant in a wrong way, but being wasteful. And I did not use for the title here the prodigal son. I should have brought in the guys, the book. That's why I was going to bring it in, because I took this title from somebody else. But why wouldn't I use prodigal son? Well, there's several reasons. But let's start reading it and we'll notice. He said, a man had two sons. This is in, I'm right, Verse 1 to 2, no, 11 to 12. Why do I have verse 1 to 2? It's 11 to 12, I think. And he said, a man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me. And he divided his wealth between them. So there are two sons here. And you typically think, well, it's going to be about these two sons that have a different approach to whatever it is. And we're going to have a contrast here. So you might think, well, it's at least about two sons, and I say it is. But why do I not want to use the term prodigal son? Well, here's why. I've got my reasons, and I'll just share them with you. First of all, the parable is not just about the prodigal son. It's not only about him. You read the parable, I don't remember how many verses it is. It's a lot of verses. And there are just as many verses that are not about him as are. So there's other things going on in this parable besides this one son. There are three main characters, not just one, not just the prodigal son. But you know, we have the father, right? We've got the one son that they call the prodigal son. That word's not there in the Bible, by the way. And you have the older son that's in there. And, well, I won't get ahead of myself here. So the point of the parable is not about being wasteful. It's not a parable to teach you and me to not be wasteful with what we have. Nobody claims that that's what the parable's about, right? It's not about take care of it. If you got some money, take care of it. Now, we teach that to, you know, or I'm trying to teach it to my grandchildren. We give them an allowance. It's part of my math class, right, when I'm teaching them. And they get an allowance once a month. And they're not having class right now, and they were all at a summer camp. And the day after the summer camp, the kids' camp was over up there in Pennsylvania, that's when they went down to South Carolina. But sure enough, there was enough time in between there that they made sure that they came to me and reminded me that it was the beginning of the month and they had allowance coming. So we're trying to teach them. But the point of this parable is not to teach my grandchildren not to be wasteful, not to be prodigal. And nobody claims it is. So the idea that it's about a prodigal son, that you can question that from the get-go, because nobody says it's about being wasteful. So what is it about? Well, and if you call the parable, I'm not being critical if you call the parable prodigal son, that's what everybody calls it. But if that's what you're thinking of when you mention this parable, you're missing half of the parable, because the second half of it, which we won't go into today, is all about the father and the older son. It's not even about the younger one anymore. There's as many verses that ignore the younger one. So, it's not just about him. It involves the father and the older brother. And in Klein Snodgrass's book that I use so often, where it talks about its stories of intent, that the big old parable book that I've shown you a few times, which I have sitting out in the truck, he calls it The Compassionate Father and His Two Lost Sons. I like that title, but it's too long. The Compassionate Father and His Two Lost Sons. So I recommend that title, or at least The Two Lost Sons. And it's not, because sometimes you read this, and we won't get into the second son today. But you read the parable and you think, well, this is a comparison between the two sons. The one who was wasteful and the one who wasn't. And, the one was good and one wasn't. And I think by the time I get done the next sermon, not this one, you'll see there's a huge difference between the two sons. Yes, but they're both lost. We won't establish that until next time. Okay. So I'll call it The Two Lost Sons. And I still have verse 1 there. I don't know how I did that. I thought I put in 11. Let's say 11 and 12, okay? So a man had two sons. The youngest of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me. And then it says that he divided his wealth between them. Now, what's implied here? Is this a good thing for this son to do? We got any thumbs up or thumbs down? Is it good to go to your father while he's still alive and ask him for your inheritance? Now, you were talking before church about the difference between the Middle East and maybe our society here and our cultures here. What do you think this request that the son is making of the father, what in the Middle East, even today, but especially a couple thousand years ago, but even today. What is implied by this, that you're asking for your inheritance before your father dies? Not happy with your father, but it could even be worse than that. When do you get your inheritance? When somebody dies. So if you ask for your inheritance while they're still alive, in a way you're saying, I wish you were dead. That's pretty bad. It's at least you could say it's not very honorable to do that. The father should be, and I'm going to read some stuff, so I won't talk about this too much now. But yeah, it could even be a death. Oh, whoops, wrong way again. Could even be a death wish. Even in our culture, you're not going to ask for that. I certainly, my brother and I would have thought of that before our parents died. You get what's coming to you if it's the way it's all, laid out. And in the Middle East, it is all laid out that way, just like it is here. And in their culture, you wouldn't need a will to do it. It's what would happen. And then, there were instructions in Torah of how to distribute an estate and who got the most of it, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, there's even an implication here. Dad, I wish you were dead, but since you're not, can I just have my money now? And that's pretty horrible. And that's why we look down on this first one, the first son. And today's sermon is only going to involve the first son, not so much the second. So that's kind of amazing at first. Now, I want you to put yourself in the sandals of the people that are listening to this, and who knows how many times Jesus gave this parable and what the audiences were when he gave it. But pretend that you're in one of those audiences. What are they hearing? Well, they're surprised. First of all, they're surprised that somebody would ask for their inheritance before their parents are dead, or the father in particular. But you know what another thing that would surprise them very much? It says, he divided his wealth between them. The father actually did it. That would be a source of some criticism. If the people are listening to this parable, they go, okay, Jesus, again, he's telling a story. This isn't a historical thing that Jesus had a neighbor that did this. He's just telling a story to make a point. That's what parables are. But the parable's already surprising in two ways, because these people that are listening to him can't imagine a son, and we're not saying it's a son's a kid. This is a son, you would figure the father's pretty old, and the son's probably got some years on him too. So they're surprised that the son would ask for this money while his father's still alive. And secondly, they'd be maybe even more surprised that the father didn't just, box his ears and tell him to go ask your mother, or whatever, say something smart to him, or just say, get out of here, get out, and, cut something in the field, do something. The audience would be very surprised and not expecting that the father would actually do what the son requested. That's even more unbelievable. Father would tell him to get lost, in a way, in so many words. That's the culture anyway. So they wouldn't have expected this. Maybe the next part you would expect after it was set up this way. Maybe you would expect it. It says, in the story here, Jesus said, and not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey into a distant country, and there he squandered his estate with loose living. Now, Jesus wasn't European, and neither was the son, but there's great pictures. I could have put a lot of pictures in here, and I got some. But they all look like they're Dutch, because Rembrandt painted a bunch of them. They definitely look like they're from Europe. Would the audience have expected this? Well, maybe because, this son's already been kind of impudent and dishonorable. But it says that he went into a distant country. And I want you to remember that. That's something that maybe, see, in America, or in the Western world in general, but especially in America, we tend to seek our fortune and fame however we can get it and wherever we can get it. And so we've been mobile from the get-go. My brother's been doing some research into the wagon road. I don't know if I mentioned this before, but there's a wagon road that came from Philadelphia, went west on, you know, roughly where 30 is now. It cut south toward Maryland where 116 comes up, or whatever, I think it's 116. It's a bunch of sheets and rudders and stuff there now. The road turned south and went into Maryland. And when it went into Maryland, went through Tawnytown, where my wife grew up. I'm just amazed to learn all this stuff, how local it all is. But then it turned west and went to the west side. It went down past Frederick, where I also lived for 16 years. But it went to the west. And I think, why did it do that? Well, it had to cross a river. It had to cross the Monocacy River before the river got too deep and the banks got too steep. And you just go and see all these things, that where these roads were and how they worked. And this was so that the immigrants and settlers of any sort that wanted to move, they could go west and get past the rivers and past the mountains and get across the Potomac and down into the what we call the Shenandoah Valley now. And you could go 81 just keeps on going. There's nothing in the way. And so once you got into that valley, you're home free in a way. Why did I talk about that? Because, you know, was it Horace Greeley said, go west, young man? You know, in America, we've always sought to better ourselves by moving wherever we need to go. That is kind of an American thing. You know, that's good. It's one of the things that's made our country what it is. But in other parts of the world, you're tied to where you live and all the people there, more so than we are here. Maybe because we all came from somewhere else anyway in the first place, so you don't get so tired. But still, even that changes even with time. As you know, we've been around long enough to see that a generation or two, or several generations ago, those people were more tied to wherever they lived once they got there. But now you can work from home, okay, so you can make home anywhere you want. And so it's different. It's just a different world. So when we read these parables, any of these parables, we have to be careful, and I've said this before, but we ought to be careful to not put the modern world into the parables, because they weren't spoken in the modern world. They were spoken, you know, in this case, a few thousand years ago. All right, so why would this not be expected? Maybe because you're leaving your village. Now I'm going to spend a little more time talking about some of this context. And this will apply to the next time I come as well. So here's some background. What's the Middle Eastern context of this whole thing? You know, when we read these parables and we live today and we have to imagine what the people are hearing, what is Jesus saying to the people that live there at the time that they live there, right? So I want to do a little bit of reading. Not much. Got a couple of books here. This is one I've been using. I've used a lot of times, from Bailey, who lived there and evangelized among Arabs for most of his career. But this is another one. It's Jesus and his parables. It's got different chapters in it from different parables. This particular chapter is written by somebody that I'm not familiar with. His name's Richard Rohrbaugh, and he writes from a social perspective, I guess, but he's got some interesting comments here about this parable and about the culture at the time and how it would have been received. First of all, we have. If we talk about the social context of the world, then we can start with saying that you have an individual, like you've got the son, right? So the son, the prodigal son, is a person, and in America, we're all about persons, aren't we? We want our rights, we want to do what we want to do, we want to be able to go and do it wherever we want to do it. We want all that stuff, and we've had the freedom to do it, and we're used to that. That is not the way the world has been for 6,000 years. That is not the way most of the rest of the world even is now. We are very, very blessed to have the opportunity to be an individual and do what an individual wants to do. That's not the case in most of the rest of the world. It certainly wasn't the case anywhere 2,000 years ago. And I'll quote from Rohrbaugh here a little bit. It's difficult for modern North Americans and Europeans reading the New Testament to set aside the individualism with which we now view the world. But ancient Mediterranean peasants were not individualistic. Instead, they are what anthropologists call dyadic persons. They internalize and make their own what others think, say, and do about them because they believe it is necessary for being human to live out the expectations of others. That's totally opposite of how we think. You know, I don't need to do what you think I need to do, and I don't really care what you think I need to do. Now, maybe that's exaggerating a little bit, but that's kind of how we are in America. And that makes room for a lot of great things. But is it all positive? I don't know. You can argue that one way or the other. So, you know, an individual is not individualistic in Jesus' time. Doesn't have an individual agenda. Doesn't have a personal, I want to do this. And I've talked about this before a little bit, like when you talk about what children, I talked about being a child in Jesus' day. Most likely, it does not 100% of the time, but 90-some percent of the time, what's your occupation going to be? It's going to be the same as what your father's was, because that's the way the world was. Well, I want to be an astronaut. You know, exaggerating, obviously. You can't have an astronaut. But, you know, you didn't think, I want to be this or I want to be that. You're glad to have a job and have, you know, your father teach you what it is, or maybe an uncle or somebody else you're going to be an apprentice to. And it was that way in our own world here at first, but we've opened up and had a lot of opportunities in our country, and that's part of our culture here, but it wasn't part of the culture when Jesus was walking here. Individual identity and worth is dependent on family and society. All right? So what matters is how your standing of your family and your position of your family. And that's why when Jesus started telling this parable, however many times he did it, the people are going, what? This kid wants his inheritance, and then he's going to go somewhere else. He's going to leave. He goes somewhere. It's just foreign to them, because that's not the way the world was. So Jesus is painting a picture here that was very different from the way it really was, and for those people that are listening to him. In peasant societies, we're continuing from Robal here. Identity is thus family identity, and not individual identity. And we don't have to look too hard in the Bible to find that. When it talks about a person like James, and it says James what? James, son of Zebedee, or James, son of Alphaeus. All right. Part of your identity and your very name was whose son you were, because that mattered. It wasn't just so you could tell people apart. It's because that's your family. That's where you come from. That's your cultural reality. That's your family. Keep reading here. Family members are deeply embedded in each other socially, economically, and psychologically. Hence, the loyalty they owe to each other is simply categorical. They watch each other constantly for hints that kin group loyalty is weak and any members acting outside the pattern of the family. I told you, this guy writes as a sociologist. Maybe he is one. I don't know. Jesus isn't worried about all that. He's just making a story to make a point. But in the culture where he's telling the story, these are the norms. Your identity depends on your family. And it's interesting here that the Roman poet Ovid, listen to what he says, because it has something to do with this parable. This is the Roman poet Ovid. He's describing a family celebration. And he says, let the innocent appear, let a disloyal brother stay far, far away. Interestingly, Ovid counts among the disloyal any brother with an excessive interest in inheriting the property, that is, anyone thinks who is, as Ovid put it, that his father is still too much alive. So even in the Roman world, this is this understanding that, no, you get the cart before the horse if you wish your father's dead and you wanted to have the inheritance. Even in the Roman world, that was dishonorable. And Ovid, you know, we can look at Ovid. So the reality is that your identity has a lot to do with your family, especially with your parents. And that was, you know, you honored them. And of course, that's biblical. That's what the Torah told us to do. There was not independence, but interdependence. You relied on your father and mother. Even not just because you're, 3 years old and you can't survive on your own, but even when you're 30 years old and 40 or whatever, you know, until your father died, you're going to work on the same land, you're going to do the same thing, you're going to help out. It's a family identity, not an individual identity. And I'm not saying this is the way it ought to be. I'm just saying it was the way it was. These are what the people who were listening to Jesus, this is the world they lived in. And survival in that environment, because most people were not rich. They were poor by our standards, very poor. But it took a village, because what if your field didn't do well 1 year? What if you got sick and you couldn't work your field? I mean, even in our own culture, we have that, right? Where people take care of you, they show up, you know. And in our, we have some bits of this still. What if you have to put up a barn? All right, and up near Pennsylvania, you got good examples of that. Everybody gets together to put the barn up, and it goes, you know, goes in a hurry. Well, that's the way it always was, and still is in a lot of the rest of the world. You can't survive on your own. You don't get this high-paying job where you commute and, you know, you have the car. You're like, we have a life that's so different from the way the world always has been and the way the world still is in a lot of places. So when we, again, we read these parables, we have to be careful not to, yeah, they apply to us, but they were told in a different world. So we have to read it in the world where it was first told and understand it that way. Survival, as I put it, takes a village. You can't, for a peasant, for a poor person in Jesus' time, you can't rely on your ability to survive year in and year out for 70 years. You're going to need the help of your neighbors. And everybody knows that. Everybody knows that. You know, when you talk about the parable, the guest that comes at midnight, you know, you go over and you knock on your neighbor's door, and your neighbor's going to give you the bread that you need. Because the whole village has a reputation. And Jesus is saying in that parable, it's like, can you imagine that your neighbor would say no? Of course not. You're never going to say no. They're going to say yes, because that's what we do. We take care of each other. That's the world that this parable was told in. Survival takes a village. Now, why are villages so important? And I could read from the book, but I'll just share some. You know, I've already gone into some of those reasons. And of course, the village, that's not where your that's not where the land you work, right? You live there and then you work the land out here, but you don't have a house. You don't also have a house out there. Your house is in the village. But you have land that is in your family that you work out there. And that's another reason why normally a son is not going to leave the family, because your means of support is whatever land you have. And this parable, of course, Jesus isn't given a zillion details, but I don't think, this guy that's writing this book, in this book, he thinks so, but I don't. And neither do most other people that write about it. They don't believe that somehow or another the father liquidated his land and gave the money that the land could have generated to the son. That doesn't make any sense. Nobody that's listening to this parable would think that would happen, because that land has to stay in your family. You're not going to sell it to somebody outside your family, or sell part of it to somebody out. You're going to certainly try not to, because that's your source of income, or source of food, or whatever. Now, the really poor people didn't even have that. They were working somebody else's land. But this guy seems to have, you know, he's got an inheritance he's going to pass on to his kids. So this story automatically assumes a certain level, you know, maybe middle class for back then, I don't know. So you depend on the village. What else do you depend on a village for?
Protection.
Hmm?
Protection.
Oh, protection, okay. Well, they were in a Rome, they probably didn't need it because they're in the Roman Empire, but yeah, you have more people there. So you have a certain defense, and you're close together. What else do you depend on a village for?
Other goods.
Huh? Other goods. Yeah, you've got all that. So you develop these relationships. You know that you can maybe sell your goat milk to, or trade your goat milk to the guy who makes yolks for your oxen or whatever. You know, you have these relationships, and you need those relationships because you can't go to Walmart. So you got to have these relationships. Or Tractor Supply Company or whatever. You can't go. What else do you need a village for? When it comes to your family and having children, where are the wives and husbands going to come from? You're going to send them somewhere else? Send them down to the city and find somebody? Now, historically, no. You know, was it say that Rebekah and Isaac were so troubled because Esau had these, you know, his wives weren't from the village, they weren't local. And it was, I think it said, I didn't look this up, isn't it Rebekah was continually troubled, or somebody was really troubled by this. You know, she wasn't in love with her daughters-in-law because they weren't local. They were from somewhere else. And that's not normal in that culture. You marry somebody that you know their family. Of course, the parents are usually, in that culture, the parents set the marriages up anyway, or tend to. And you're going to set it up with somebody you know. That's good people. You know, it's going to be good. It's going to work out because we know them. They're good people. They'll take care of you. So it's different than now. I'm glad that my parents didn't pick out my wife. Yeah, in America we think we don't want to think that. But, it's very different. The point of saying all this is to say, all right, we got to leave our own bubble here and get over into that bubble to understand what's being said. The world was basically immobile. That's why you really depended on your village, because you shouldn't just hop in your car and go 300 miles somewhere else. Now, occasionally people did migrate. They migrated because of war, famine, you know, the major thing. They didn't migrate because they had a job opportunity that they saw on LinkedIn and they could go, you know, get another job. It was because the situation where you lived was not advantageous. And so you uprooted your whole family and moved, just like the whole, you know, Jacob's children, they all went down to Egypt, and then at another time they all left, went back. Those were unusual occurrences. They weren't normal things that happened all the time. You relied on your village, and you didn't go far out of it. And there was honor in the village, like I was talking about with the neighbor. You know, you have a guest, and you don't have any bread. You know your neighbor will come through. And we have that. We do have those things in our society, too. It's not like it's totally different, but there are a lot of differences. Here's one we don't, we claim we don't like to conform, but we do. It's just part of human nature. We want to conform to each other socially, and we do. And that makes our world go around in a smoother way. And we always laugh about it, right? As the next generation comes along, and they don't want to conform. And so they all do the same thing, but it's different. It's different from what I did. You know, my children want to do something that's different than what I did, but then they all want to do it. So they conform. It's just a different conformity. People that are non-conformists are just conforming to a different conformity. That's all, usually. There are very few people that just stand out and don't do anything like anybody else does. We care what people think about us. Well, that's the way it was in Jesus' time, too. A disadvantage, perhaps, in a village, and some of you may have lived in areas like this, everybody knows everybody else's business, right? It doesn't take long before the whole village, you know, you got Floyd the barber there in Mayberry, right? As soon as he finds out, everybody knows. Well, there's somebody like that in every village. And when Jesus' disciples and friends and hangers-on and people that come for the food and whatever reason they're all there, hear this story, one of the things that's got to be on their mind is that, you know, when the son does this, the whole village is going to look down on him. And when the father actually gives him the money, they're all going to look down. You know, there's this understanding that everybody's going to know about it and everybody's going to be critical. So that's just part of the package. So just as I said, in the family situation, in the village situation, there's interdependence. This person has that trait, this person has that trait, this person grows food, this person, you know. And they all depend on each other to survive. And they help to take care of each other in bad times. And lastly, you have whatever's not in your village. And I just call it the greater world. You kind of don't need you don't really care what Caesar does because he's so far away. As long as he doesn't take too much tax, and as long as the military is not coming and stealing your stuff, it's just that's far away. We don't really care because it's all we can do to grow enough food to eat tomorrow. And so the rest of the world, you might need it for whatever reason, but you don't. So again, it was surprising, I think, to Jesus' listeners when the son said he took his money and he just went somewhere else. He left family behind. He left friends behind. He left his village behind and just went somewhere else where they didn't know who he was. and he didn't have any connections. That would be unusual, to say the least. It's not normal in that culture. So let's go back. I kind of said these things now. Man had two sons, and the younger one says, you know, he wants his portion of the estate. You know, what's the audience hearing here? Are they, what are they hearing in this request? What are all the neighbors thinking? Now, again, it's a made up story, but if there were real neighbors, what are they thinking about this? It's dishonorable, like you said before, right? Very dishonorable. And, you know, they're wishing that, he's wishing that his father was dead. What would they think about his decision to just go out and live on his own somewhere in a strange world? We might encourage our children to go out there and, you know, see what's out there. Make, you know, what's the word? Break a leg, as they tell people in the, when you're acting, whatever. You know, get out there and do it. That's not the culture that this parable was told in. I would submit that they're surprised. Sorry, wrong way. That this man, younger than his father, we don't know how young he's supposed to be, doesn't say, doesn't matter. But he's going to go out and try to make it on his own somewhere where he has no connections, no family, no support system. He's just got a bag of money. How long is that going to last? Now, you, even today, you've had conversations with people who, and, you know, maybe it's involved their own family, maybe it's somebody who's your neighbor, whatever, but, you know, they'll talk about, oh, so-and-so's sick, or so-and-so's having a problem pregnancy, or they just had the baby sick. And they live out here, you know, where they moved because, he took this job out here, they don't have any family, and what do we say? They have no support system. They have no support. You know, it's hard. Well, we still make it because we have a lot of safety nets in our country. But, you know, back then they didn't. If you didn't have that support system, that you're on your own. And I think, again, the people that are listening to this parable are saying, this is not smart. This young man should stay home. Not, you know, just take, because how money only can last so long. So it wasn't, I don't think, looked at as a wise decision. And of course, everybody knows about it. They all know about it. So the guy, you know, he's moving to somewhere where he doesn't have family, doesn't have village, doesn't have the support system. Just not a good move. Not a good move. Plus, they all know about it, and they all have a comment. All right, so the father does it. And I already said that this seems to be odd. But this invites more judgment. I don't agree with that. Again, I don't think he sold, you know, that Jesus is implying that he sold the land. They wouldn't expect that. But still, he somehow or another divvied it up. And maybe they gave him money for the value of the land they would have sold. Who knows? It doesn't, the details don't matter because it's not important to the point of the story. But I'm just trying to get us all into the sandals of the people that are listening to this. There's a lot of judgment going on because, man, this just doesn't happen. This doesn't make sense. And it says that not many days later, he went on a journey with a bunch of Dutch people and squandered his estate with loose living. So that's why he's called the prodigal son, because he wasted the money that he was given. And there's all kind of pictures, Rembrandt, but I couldn't show them. You wouldn't show them in mixed company. I think the Europeans like painting pictures of the loose company. The harlot living, as the older brother calls it, we'll talk about next time. So here we have, all this is not good, and plus the father enabled it, as we would say in modern psychological jargon. He's the enabler. He gave him the money so he could go do this. And what's the audience hearing again? You know, is it disrespect for the family, the village, for everybody that the son would do this? But then we read, when he spent all his money, there was a famine, and he began to be impoverished. He couldn't even get enough to eat. Okay, this is, of course, that's the way. Everybody knew from the beginning of the story that this is what's going to happen. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country. So he didn't have a support system. He had to just go get a real job from somebody he didn't know. And that person sent him out in his fields to feed the pigs. And he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating, but no one would give him anything. So the poor guy had betrayed, really himself, but his family, his village, everybody. He trashed all those relationships, and now he's stuck. And then it says, depending on which translation you read, you know, he comes to himself. In New American Standard, it says, when he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, but I'm dying here with hunger? I will get up, go to my father, and I'll say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men. So he realizes he's really stuck. People argue about whether he really repented or not. Who knows? It's a story. It's made up. He does say, you know, sorry, but he's not looking for grace here in the way we understand it. He's looking for a job. He said, I'll come back and be one of the servants. So at least he's sorry, somewhat. Come back and be one of the servants. Whoops. And it says he got up and came to his father. And that's where I'm going to stop. I'm not going to go any further because that's for the next time. Verse 20. So at least one of the two lost sons is now looking to be found. He's headed back home. And we'll take that up next time and see where it leads.